why detention is so takes this psychological toll is because they have no idea how long they're going to be in detention. So the suspense kills them, in a sense. In his case, I think he had high hopes of being released because I visited one of his friends in Broward Transitional Center a couple of weeks ago, and he told me he had received a letter written in Ohio by Zeres and I, who mentioned in the letter that he expected to be released in a week or two. And so it must have, I mean, he must have been just struck.
Did you feel, that Christine Ho, that this deportation was a death sentence for Zeres and I?
It could very well be, in the sense that it must have filled him with such hopelessness and despair, as well as fear of what he might experience if he actually did return to his homeland.
Christine, in the last minute we have, can you talk about the psychological effects of long-term detention? You visited hundreds of detainees at the Broward County facility. Zeres and I had been there for about a year.
Yes. It takes a tremendous toll. They, first of all, it's especially difficult for asylum seekers because the process of processing asylum claims takes a long time, months, sometimes years. And they feel, and because they have no idea how long it's going to be, it really takes a psychological toll. It's been described by others as soul destroying. It's also a very difficult experience on a day-to-day basis, daily indignities, daily humiliations, and also pettiness. It's in addition to the medical issues that were discussed by Clara Long.
Christine Ho, we have to end the show here. I want to thank you for being with us, founding director of Friends of Broward Detainees. And we'll continue to follow this case and see if Zeres and I's body is returned. We want to wish Karen Bernucci a happy birthday. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable group of people. Special thanks to Renee Feltz, Mike Burke. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn. Featuring local and independent artists.
Once upon a time, there was a nice house that lived with a family. The house loved the family and took care of them. One day, it started to rain and rain. The house wanted to protect the family, but the water got inside and ruined everybody's everythings. The house was so sad, but the family didn't think it could happen. They told the house that they would take better care of her, always.
Protect what matters. Learn more about your flood risk at floodsmart.gov/care.
Hey, knucklehead, what are you doing?
Just throwing away this old WHFR loyal listener guy.
Well, make sure you recycle it, lame brain.
I know.
Better yet, why not save a tree and sign up for the WHFR e-newsletter instead?
WHFR has an electronic newsletter?
Yeah, you just need to go to their website, Hey, pay attention when I'm talking to you. WHFR.FM and hit the sign-up link. It has all the same bells and whistles of the paper newsletter.
Really?
Yeah, it's the most up-to-date WHFR info sent right to your email box. You got one of those, don't you?
Yeah, I got three of them.
Ah, you wise guy. Think about it.
Yeah. No more running up to the record store to get my copy and saving me on gas, too. Info sent right to my email box. That makes me very happy.
Well, okay, Mr. Happy. Let's go to WHFR.FM right now and sign you up.
Yeah, let's go do it.
It's informative, quicker, and easier on the environment. It's the WHFR electronic newsletter. Visit our website, WHFR.FM, and sign up today.
Hey, It's WHFR 89.3, also online at WHFR.FM, Making Waves. I'm Alan Mazurek. Susan McGraw and I are continuing our little summer vacation here from the new WHFR Journal so that we can bring you another very fascinating series of programs that we have found. This one deals with education in America. It's called Degrees of Separation, and it's going to run for the next few weeks in place of the new WHFR Journal. Don't worry, we will be back in due time with a fresh take on the new WHFR Journal. We do hope you'll stick around and enjoy this program. It's a part of our public service to you, our listeners, as we look at education in America on the program Degrees of Separation. Here on WHFR, we're always making waves.
From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is With Good Reason. American high schools didn't really take off until the 1950s.
It's not until the 1930s that a majority of teenagers even enter a high school. It's not until after the Second World War that a majority graduate.
Plus, is schooling necessarily a zero-sum game?
I'm a socially mobile person who wants to go to school in order to get ahead. That means I want to get ahead of other people. That means other people are going to be behind me.
And the problems of school policy have a lot to do with expectations.
I think we do tend to have this belief that there's an easy fix for education. We often are looking for the silver bullet.
All this and more today on With Good Reason. First, the news.
I'm Liz, and this is your neighborhood news. Crestwood High School band directors Matt Ridnor and Jacette Rakul created a way to make sure your child is safe during a school shooting. The TABS app, Tracking Appropriate Behavior System, works as a school security program. The pressing guide says it can help monitor students during lockdown situations after the principal notifies teachers and staff. The app also tracks students' attendances and tardies. It will be launched by the end of this week. Dearborn is one of the best cities in the nation for music education. According to the National Association of Music Merchants Foundation, DPS is one of the 16 districts in Michigan to be recognized. Programs in the district offer students many opportunities to expand on their musical abilities as well as reaching out to other communities to help expand theirs. School Superintendent Glenn Maleko says it is wonderful to be nationally recognized as one of the best districts in the country for music education. Doctors Without Borders will be recruiting at the Dearborn Performing Arts Center on June 28th. According to the pressing guide, the group is seeking help in the Middle East. They are looking for Arabic-speaking doctors, nurses, and non-medical professionals. The session will have a presentation as well as a question-and-answer meeting. The event starts at 7 p.m., and for more information, call 212-763-5740. The Detroit Institute of Arts is holding a 50th anniversary celebration for the 1968 Tigers baseball team. The Mirror News says the exhibit called Play Ball Baseball will be showing one of the rarest baseball cards. Also on display are uniforms from the 68 World Series where the Tigers defeated the St. Louis Cardinals. To wrap up the 50th anniversary, both present-day teams are having a celebration in early September.
9 in 10 Americans went to a public school. It's one of the things that binds us together as a nation. Public schools teach us to read, write, and count. They prepare us for the workplace and teach us how to be good citizens. It's where we knit America's social fabric. The great promise of public education is equality, an excellent education for every child. And yet there's a sense, from nearly every side of the debate, that America is falling short of that promise. I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, we begin a 6-part series we're calling Degrees of Separation. We'll explore how schools reinforce inequality, from discipline in the inner cities to standardized testing in the suburbs, and whether those same schools, with the right support, might fulfill the promise of an excellent education. So here we go. We're starting at the beginning, the very beginning. We're looking at the origins of education in civilization, with some help from associate producer John Last. John's with me right now. Hey, John.
Hi, Sarah. So right off the bat, I need to apologize. I failed in my task.
Oh, no. What did you do?
Well, I can't actually go back to the dawn of time and see what one caveman was saying to another caveman when the first moment of education happened. Oh. But what I can do is go back through recorded history and ask the question, where did our most sacred ideas of education come from?
Did you do a little nosing around?
Oh, yeah. I went pretty far back. And I think I have an answer.
In the beginning was the Word.
If you want to understand the history of Western education, you might as well start here. But I'm not talking about the Bible. 2,000 years before this line was written in the Gospel of John, the written Word was still a hot new thing. And if we're really going to take this back, all the way back to the beginning, we have to start in ancient Sumeria. If you go to the Library of Congress today, you can still see them. Little clay tablets inscribed by shaky-handed novices practicing the words for beer and field. These tablets are the world's earliest example of a lesson plan crafted by some ancient educator in Mesopotamia, today's Iraq. The novices are practicing the cuneiform alphabet, one of the world's first written languages. They're learning it by rote, a form of learning that, for better or for worse, is still with us today. And what they're learning is extremely practical. How to record an interest rate or describe a quantity of sheep. In these ancient societies, education had to be practical. Literacy was reserved for a special clerical class whose job it was to read, write, and calculate. For thousands of years, this view of education as skills training for the elite reigned supreme. But in the 5th century BCE, a new idea of education emerged, thanks to a certain ugly old Greek you might already know. Socrates.
Socrates thought that the unexamined life is not worth living for a human being. And, you know, I take that as a kind of imperative.
That's Brent Cusher. He's a professor of Greek history at Christopher Newport University, who teaches a course called The Liberal Education. To Cusher, Socrates represents a new way of thinking about education, one that viewed it not as an accumulation of skills, but as an initiation into a new inquiring worldview.
The most famous image of education is the allegory of the cave. Human beings and their nature are enchained at the bottom of a cave and are looking only at shadows on the wall.
Shadows cast by puppeteers, invisible to the enchained subjects. For Socrates, these shadows are the misguided ideals, opinions, and beliefs that we use to guide our lives.
What happens is a teacher comes down, an educator comes down and liberates somebody from the chains and takes them up outside of the cave and allows them to see, and in some cases compels them to see what's really the truth of the world. And so what that means, I think, is that education for Socrates is not so much a filling up of empty vessels with knowledge, but rather reorienting your eyesight, turning your soul around to truly see things as they are.
If we were to demystify this Socratic idea, we might say that education should be about instilling a love of learning. It's a belief you can find expressed on most school websites today. It's a good principle, maybe even a great one. But if you look at history, it's not really the way we do things. Look even just a few hundred years after Socrates, and in the schools of ancient Rome, educators were saying no to mystical spelunking, and yes to good old-fashioned job training.
The Romans preeminently were farmers, lawyers, and soldiers. They were very interested in practical things, so for them, education was all about practical skills.
That's Stephen Chappell. He's a professor of history at James Madison University. He says that while the Greeks were inventing philosophy, the Romans were inventing concrete. And it was this pragmatic, structured spirit that gave us one of our earliest models for organizing education.
You see these early schools being set up for young children, where they're taught the three R's from the age of about seven. You see them go on to someone called a grammaticus, a teacher of grammar, of literature, at the age of 12. And then by 15, they're on to the rhetor, who teaches them rhetoric.
For the most part, only the most spoiled of Roman brats would go on to the rhetor, following in the footsteps of some wealthy lawyer daddy, no doubt. But in other ways, the Roman system was much more ambitious than what came before. Romans were literate across social classes in much greater numbers than other ancient societies. For provincial types, an education in Latin became a way to integrate with the conquering class. And interestingly, many slaves were also literate to better carry out the tasks appointed to them by their masters. It's from this fact that we get one of our earliest stories of public education as a tool for social mobility. Here's Chappell.
Publius Helvius Pertinax was the son of a freedman, a slave who'd been freed, and he started his career as a grammaticus, as a teacher of grammar. And he found that the status was awful and that money was awful, so some things don't change. So he went into the army and worked his way up through the ranks of the army, through the Senate, and in AD 193 becomes Roman Emperor.
As nice as that story may be, Rome was still only educating a very small elite. And with the collapse of the Roman Empire in 480 CE, things only got worse. Civic life disintegrated, and learning withdrew to the countryside. Here's Philip Daleader, a professor of medieval history at the College of William & Mary.
Once the urban infrastructure is gone, the schools collapse and disappear, and the ideals of civic education are gone. Where you find formal schooling, it's in monasteries that have deliberately cut themselves off from the outside world.
You would think this would give the system some uniformity. Students may not be learning Roman virtue from Britain to Greece anymore, but at least we're all reading the same Bible, right?
One of the funny things about medieval education is it's very unruly. You have monastic schools, but you also have grammar schools, and then you have cathedral schools that are run by bishops. Then you have independent schools run by teachers, and then eventually you get universities. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach.
And even though we remember many of these schools for enshrining the liberal arts as the highest of sciences, Daleader calls medieval education brutally utilitarian.
When you look at the people who go to school, it is always, always, always related to some form of professional advancement.
Third sons studied theology to increase their chance of climbing the church hierarchy. Merchants studied Latin to better their trade. And over time, Latin went from being the language that allowed Publius Pertinax to become emperor of Rome to the language of an elite class of pan-European intellectuals. By the end of the Middle Ages, the working poor of Europe no longer even spoke the same language as their would-be educators. For centuries, this exclusive system of education was never questioned. But finally, in the 18th century, it was. And in the most unlikely of places, the court of King Frederick the Great of Prussia. In the 18th century, Prussia was a new state, and Frederick saw in education an opportunity to craft a new identity for his subjects. So he proposed a radical idea. Universal, public, primary education for every child, rich and poor. But if you're starting to picture Frederick as a great democratizer, you might want to pump the brakes.
The thing we tend to forget about the Prussian model is that the reason Frederick the Great wanted the state to be able to reach into every home and start molding children was basically a militaristic vision.
That's Eric Lindstrom, a professor of modern history at the University of Virginia.
So this wasn't about certainly preparing citizens for democracy at that point. It wasn't about humanistic education. At that point, it was really about molding soldiers, the cannon fodder of tomorrow, and sort of learning habits of discipline and obedience and those kinds of things.
Far from manufacturing Socratic super citizens, students with a love of virtue and an inquiring mind, Frederick wanted subjects not to question their nation's civic virtues.
We want children to learn the national anthem. We want them to salute the flag. This is an era that historians often talk about as the era of invented traditions.
The Prussian system of education was one of those invented traditions, spreading like wildfire across Europe. And in a period of rising state power, nationalism, and democratization, public education became a means of eliminating difference and silencing dissent. It's that DNA that's at the core of every modern public education system. That's where my story ends. But it's not the end of the story. In the 19th century, the United States saw some very different ideas of education come to the fore.
While Europeans were reinventing their schools to build better soldiers, the Industrial Revolution was changing education on American shores. To explain how American education changed in the 19th century, I'm joined by Jonathan Zimmerman. He's a leading author on the history of education and a professor at Penn State's Graduate School of Education. Jonathan, how did the Industrial Age change schooling in America?
Well, you know, the Industrial Revolution, we typically think of beginning around 1880, and it's fueled by the railroad. This is also the era of mass immigration, especially from Southern and Eastern Europe. And they provide a good part of the labor force for this Industrial Revolution. So you've got a railroad that's enabling distribution of mass-produced goods, and you have a large, and I should say often easily exploited, labor force that's ready and willing to work in these factories.
And this is causing what effect on the schools?
It's causing a lot of anxious hand-wringing on the part of the WASP elite. Look at all these unwashed masses coming into our cities. What are we going to do with them? And most of all, how are we going to make them American? That's clearly one impetus for the expansion of schools at the time. It's also during this era that what you see in these new enlarged high schools is you often see three different academic programs. You see the academic one for the kids that were expected to go on to other kinds of schooling, including college. You see a commercial one for kids that are going to work in offices and other parts of the corporate revolution that is also happening in cities. And then you have what would be called manual or later vocational tracks. When you have all these millions of newcomers coming into the schools, there's also this need to sort them in ways that never happened in prior generations. You think of the one-room schoolhouse, everyone in the community between ages 5 and 20 went to that school. They weren't even sorted by age.
Right.
Now we're going to sort them not just by age, but also by their imagined occupational futures.
This was happening around when? In ever larger high schools in the major cities or all across America?
Well, first in the major cities, but then on the countryside, when in the 20s and especially the 1930s, we see the consolidation of these smaller schools and school districts into larger ones. This was a big New Deal initiative. In the 1930s, remember, the New Deal witnesses this big state expansion, and we have these alphabet agencies with names like the Public Works Administration. And one of the big activities of these new agencies on the countryside is to build new consolidated schools, which would often have names like the Jonesville Central School. You can still see that name in many parts of the United States, and it's a legacy of this consolidation period.
And was this a period where all Americans were going K through 12 to school?
Definitely not. although the primary schools attracted millions and millions of kids in the 19th century and became, you could fairly call them, mass institutions, it's not until the Great Depression, until the 1930s, that a majority of teenagers, 14 to 17, even enter a high school. It's not until after the Second World War that a majority graduate. Now, why? Well, it's pretty simple. During the Great Depression, it's very hard to get work. And so kids who otherwise would have, at the age of 13, 14, gone directly into the workforce, they go to school because there's nowhere else for them to go.
When did we get compulsory education? Is education compulsory by the 1930s?
Oh, definitely. You know, states start to pass compulsory education laws really in the late 1880s, 1890s, around the time that states also passed child labor laws, banning child labor. But it's really important to understand that these laws are unevenly enforced, if enforced at all. It's really not until the Great Depression that you see the rise of truant officers and you see a real concerted effort to make sure the kids are in school. It's also the time where, sadly, I think it's fair to say that a lot of schools become custodial institutions. And by custodial institutions, I don't mean they're training custodians. I mean that one of their prime functions is to have a place for the kids to go, a place with a roof, a place with heat, a place where they serve lunch, which, by the way, was assisted by the federal government, which is also a legacy of the New Deal. If you think about what's happening in the United States at that time, it does make sense that schools would have a kind of custodial function, and it dates to the 1930s. It's also important to know that the New Deal assisted kids who wanted to stay in school. So you think about the National Youth Administration, what was that? That was helping give small payments to kids and sometimes part-time jobs, if they existed, in order to allow families to continue to send the kid to school. Now, I should tell you, it wasn't all peaches and cream in the schools because they're still paid for by localities. Their tax coffers are way down. So in some cities, the teachers just aren't paid. You know, some of the schools went to double and even triple shift. What that means is double shift is, you know, some kids come in the morning and leave and other kids come in the afternoon. But there were schools in the 1930s that were on triple shift, meaning one group of kids comes, say, at 6 in the morning, leaves at 9. Another group comes at 9, leaves at 12. Another group comes at 12, leaves at 3, like that, because the school districts are so strapped.
Were the high schools before this period educating mainly the children of the elite?
Well, at the beginning of the high schools, so if you think about the high schools that were created in the 19th century, the answer to that is mostly yes. Not necessarily elite, but people who at least could fairly be called middle class. People who imagine themselves joining what was already known as the, quote, white-collar workforce. The real revolution in education in the 20th century is that the high schools will become truly mass institutions, catering not just to the upper and middle class, but to the working class and the poor as well.
What simultaneously is happening with the education of African Americans?
Well, let's remember that during the time we're talking about, the majority of African Americans still live in the South. And let's also remember that starting in the same era, in the early 1900s, you have the creation of what would be called Jim Crow. You have the creation of state-sponsored, indeed state-mandated segregation. And with that came the large-scale disenfranchisement of African Americans as voters, indeed as citizens. If there were any appropriations for African American education, they were paltry. They were sometimes a tenth or a 20th. Per kid, per capita, of what the appropriations for the white schools were. And so a couple of things happened. First of all, white philanthropists in the North started to organize their own campaigns to try to improve African American education in the South. First, you see the General Education Board, which is a Rockefeller-funded effort based out of New York City. And then you also see Julius Rosenwald building schools or improving the physical plant. Most of these philanthropists envision black education in very limited terms and, I think, to our sensibilities, highly racist terms. they imagine African Americans as having limited capacities. So they design an education that is in many ways an education for serfdom, an education to create a skilled but pliant manual workforce. And yet, it's important to emphasize that African Americans have their own ideas about education and that they often change these institutions to make the institutions much more academic and often college preparatory.
Simultaneously during this period, was there a debate within the African American community over whether there should be African American students trained for the labor force or whether they should be trained for college prep?
Definitely. You know, and of course, we associate this debate most prominently with the figures of Booker T. Washington and W.B. Du Bois. The Booker T. Washington idea, more than anything else, was black self-sufficiency. But even though he still believed that a majority of African Americans would be, quote, hand workers, manual workers, he also saw these institutions as providing a springboard for people to go beyond that, and many of them did.
Conversely, W.B. Du Bois thought what?
Du Bois also imagined a so-called talented tenth, as he called it, of African Americans who would get a highly, highly academic, indeed an elite education. Remember, Du Bois himself was the first African American to get a PhD from Harvard. And in order for that to happen, and here I think is the real difference, Du Bois believed that there needed to be changes in the political sphere. Booker T. Washington thought that would come later.
In these large schools that were being built in the North as immigrants were streaming in to work in American factories, were African Americans also attending those industrial age schools?
Well, they were, but let's keep in mind a few things. First of all, you know, pre-World War I, the vast majority of African Americans are still in the South. And they're attending, if they go to school at all, the segregated institutions of the Jim Crow South. World War I changes that because during wartime, the industrial economy heats up and there was more demand for black labor. And this is what triggers the so-called Great Migration in the wake of the First World War to cities like Chicago and Philadelphia. In those places, African Americans were often segregated themselves, which is one of the tragic ironies of this entire story, right? You leave a place that is segregated by law, and you come to a place that's segregated by redlining, by real estate companies who will only sell to blacks or whites in certain parts of town. So African Americans, like other people from the working class, and they are mostly working class, attempt most of all to get themselves and their kids jobs. When they can't, they send them to schools. But already in cities like Chicago in the 30s and 40s, you find the municipal school authorities segregating black kids, placing black schools in poor parts of town, in less adequate buildings, and I should say, even within schools that were integrated, often shunting black kids into vocational and manual type tracks, whether they, quote, merited it or not. You know, one of the problems with the way that we tell historical stories is we want everything to be linear, right? So we want everything to be a straight line. So you go from, I don't know, discrimination to equality, something like that. But it's rarely that tidy. What happened in a city like Chicago is you had this massive migration of all these newcomers to the city, which created enormous racial panic among the whites of the city. And that led to all these new and invidious kinds of discrimination.
People sometimes talk about this idea that American schools of this era were designed to train factory workers, teach students to be better factory workers. Does that line up with your view of history?
It doesn't. I think that's an enormous myth, and there are two reasons why I think it's a myth. The first thing to understand is that even though some of the educational reformers of the era had that vision, that is, wanted to see the high schools, quote, train an industrial workforce, you didn't actually need to go to school to get an industrial job. It's true that the schools had, quote, vocational tracks. But the other point I want to make is that these tracks were hugely unpopular among the working class. The vocational education story in the United States is in many ways a shaggy dog story, and that's what we used to call a story that just goes kind of on and peters out. There's all this sound and fury about it, but the working class doesn't sign up for it. People who sent their kids to school, when they were told the kid would be in a vocational track, they'd say, well, wait a second. If the kid's going to be a worker, I'm just going to send him or her to the factory.
Right.
So even though it's true that some educators had a vision of the kind you're describing, that is, the high school is a place to train manual workers, it is a myth that the high school served that function.
But didn't people need to go to school to support themselves?
The answer to that is no. And it's really only in my own lifetime, and I was born in 1961, where the answer becomes yes. Look, let me just give you an illustration that I often give to my students. When my wife and I lived in Baltimore in the mid-80s, our next-door neighbor was a guy, he was retired. He had worked his whole life at Beth Steele, at Bethlehem Steele, there in Baltimore. He had an eighth-grade education, and he owned his home. That's never going to happen again in American history. Except for your occasional pop music star or pro athlete, nobody with a grade school education is ever going to be a homeowner. Now, why is that? I would argue that it has nothing to do with education, everything to do with the economy. It's not that back then the schools were so great and they were preparing everybody so well. No. What it was is the economy had a totally different structure, and that structure did not require formal education as a sine qua non of self-sufficiency. In our own lifetime, formal education has become an absolute prerequisite for self-sufficiency. But we're really the first generation, now I'm talking about my generation, for whom that's been the case. So we have to be done with the myth that the schools are worse than they were. Are they inadequate? They absolutely are. But the reason they're inadequate is not that they're worse than they were before. It's that the demands we're making on them are so much greater, and we have not reformed them in a way that would help us meet that demand.
Jonathan Zimmerman, thank you for sharing your insights today on With Good Reason.
Thank you. It was fun.
Jonathan Zimmerman is an historian of education at Penn State's Graduate School of Education. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back.
I knew there was a better career out there for me, but I couldn't afford to quit my job to get the necessary education. Thanks to Henry Ford College, I didn't have to. In just 2 years, I earned my associate's degree and was ready to start a new career in the industry I love. I work hard for myself and for my family, and I've earned the chance to advance in my job and in my life. Henry Ford gave me that chance. I'm a Henry Ford College graduate, and I'm future driven.
Henry Ford College, future driven.
In 2014, The Flick by Annie Baker won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama and the 2013 Obie Award for Playwriting. And starting on Thursday, June 14th, the Henry Ford College Theater Arts Department presents this award-winning play directed by HFC theater instructor Brandon Gantz. The Flick will run for 8 performances from the Adjoy Auditorium in Building F of Henry Ford College's main campus. HFC students are offered a discounted ticket price, and you can go online to hfcc.edu and click on Campus Life for more information and to purchase tickets.
Welcome back. This is With Good Reason. The story of America's school system can be told with names and dates, as we just did, but it can also be told as a story of shifting priorities. My next guest, David Labery, is a professor of education at Stanford University. He argues that since the beginning of our public schools, three distinct goals have competed to define American education.
Well, one is a political goal, and that was actually the original one. The aim is to prepare people to be citizens in a democracy, to have the knowledge they need, the skills they need, and the commitment to the community they need in order to function well. A second is an economic rationale for schooling, which we hear about a lot today. That's the one that says we need to prepare people to be productive workers. And the third I call social mobility, which is the aim for individuals. Schooling is the way we try to get ahead. It's also the way that people who already are ahead try to preserve their advantage. So all three of those are embedded in school. It's hard to extricate ourselves from any of them completely.
Are there tensions, do you feel, with trying to achieve all three goals simultaneously?
Yes, lots of tensions, and I think that's a way to understand the kind of dynamic of the system. It's not a static system, but one that changes over time, and these different aims of the system push back and forth against each other. For example, both the democratic equality and social efficiency conceive of schooling as a public good, something that we all benefit from. We all benefit by having competent voters. We all benefit by having productive people around us who raise the economy and provide a better standard of living for all of us. But that social mobility goal is very much of an individual goal. It's my way to get ahead. It's also my way to stay ahead. In that sense, it's very much of an every person for himself situation that's quite different from these other two, which are thinking about schooling as something that provides a broad social benefit.
The third goal, this idea of public school education as a way to promote social mobility, some people refer to it as education as an anti-poverty mechanism, if you will. Do you see that as an achievable goal?
Not at all. Not at all. If you want to reduce inequality, don't do it through education. Education will help individuals make their move. It can help the Alexander Hamiltons rise to the top, but to take entire groups of people and move them up and reduce the gap between the top and the bottom, that's something that schools are simply ill-equipped to do. In order to reduce the gap between top and bottom, you not only have to raise the floor, you have to put a lid on the ceiling. And in a liberal democracy, it's really hard to do that. You can't tell people, no, you don't need to go to graduate school. We have too many lawyers already. We're going to try to reduce the education gap here and compress the differences. That simply has not been politically feasible. So we have an elevator system. The floor rises, and so does the ceiling. And the gap between the top and the bottom never really changes. We've seen that throughout the history of American schooling.
But think about the period of desegregation, how hard fought it was to level the playing field for black children and white children by integrating the schools. Have we achieved social mobility for African American children in the wake of desegregation?
It's interesting. There are things that schools can do, and desegregation was an important move. That said, however, we still have very segregated schools. The large majority of students go to a school where almost everybody in the school looks like them. One thing the schools are better at, I think, is integrating immigrants into a society. And for an immigrant country like this, that's been a particularly important thing, to bring people from all over the world and turn them into Americans. And schooling has played a central role in that.
Which part of schooling has done that best?
Elementary, for sure. Elementary is the is the socializing element. It's the one that brings everybody together, puts them in a single classroom, and exposes them to a single experience. The higher you go in the system, the more separated we get. The big melting pot in American schools is the elementary school.
You believe that we ask education, public school education, to do something that it can't fully do.
That's true. I think we put a lot of stress on schooling because we have chosen to use schooling as our primary mechanism for promoting the social welfare. In the 19th century, when European countries like Britain and Germany were developing the beginnings of a welfare state, we were developing a radically expansive public school system. It's our alternative in many ways to the welfare state. Instead of saying we're going to provide you with social security and a safety net and help when you're out of work, we instead provide schooling and say we're going to give you opportunity and you need to take advantage of it. And if you don't, then it's your fault.
You argue in your book, Someone Has to Fail, that really public school education is a zero-sum game, that there will always be winners and losers. That's a very depressing thought.
It is, but that's basically what we wanted to do. Think about it this way. If I'm a socially mobile person who wants to go to school in order to get ahead, that means I want to get ahead of other people. That means other people are going to be behind me. The whole nature of getting ahead is to move up a hierarchy, but the aim is not to get rid of the hierarchy. It's just to establish a better place in it for myself.
So we have a fundamental conflict between our ideals and what we want for ourselves and our children. We ideally, as Americans, think that we should provide opportunity for all children, but individually we want the best possible advantage for our own children. And this plays out through public education.
And people make those trade-offs all the time, and it causes a lot of anxiety. Think about upper middle class parents when they start thinking about going to school. Like my own parents, when they decided to pull me out of the public school and send me to a private one. They were committed to the public schools, like lots of parents are. They want everyone to get a good education. They don't want to see other people disadvantaged. On the other hand, they don't want their own children to be put into a situation where their own opportunities are going to be stunted or where their own educational experience is going to be weak. If you want to make education professors really uncomfortable, we are, of course, completely committed to the value of public schools, is to ask them, where do your own kids go to school? And you'll find that if they are not going to a private school, they are going to a school that was picked very carefully and where they bought a house very carefully to be in the right school district and to avoid the wrong school district. So we do try to have it both ways.
But there are also many children who escape this and achieve great success in spite of mediocre schooling.
Absolutely, yes. And it's really places like community colleges and regional state universities that are the real motors of upward mobility. Places like San Jose State University, these open access the regional state universities that are relatively low cost, that are easily accessible, and that provide people from working class backgrounds the chance to really move up.
For K-12 public education, though, you present a fairly pessimistic view of things. What does that say to teachers or for struggling parents who are sending their children to public schools? Do we throw up our hands and say, well, we're really not going to close the achievement gap. Why try?
I know. My students complain about this all the time. I teach a course called The History of School Reform that a lot of people come into thinking, like, I'm going to tell them how to fix schools. And the history of school reform is a fairly depressing story about people creating more problems than they solve when they try to fix schools. At the end, I try to turn that around by saying, look, you're a teacher in a classroom. If you are trying to save everybody, you're going to burn yourself out quickly. You're pushing against the tide. But you're in a position where you do what you can where you are. You try to understand the tensions in the classroom, you understand the structural problems the students and you are facing, and you try to do the best you can to provide people with an experience that's opening up rather than closing opportunities. That's giving them a sense of their own capabilities rather than their own incapabilities. You want to be one of the people that's encouraging people to trust their own skills and develop them rather than show them, you're not good at school, you ought to just move on.
I'm curious, over the course of your decades of study of these issues about the education gap, inequality in education, have you changed? Has closer examination altered your view as time has gone on?
Yeah, I think I've become, as I've gotten older, I've gotten more prone to be, instead of railing against the system, to being someone who's trying to understand the system. I keep telling my students that I know you want to change things. I know you're unhappy with the way schools work. You want to intervene, but you want to intervene in a knowledgeable, sensible manner. You don't want to be tinkering with a system that you don't understand fully, because when you do that, you're simply going to create lots of unintended consequences that are going to cause harm. I'm trying to encourage them to think a little more like, well, in terms of the Hippocratic Oath, you know, first do no harm. I have a sneaking admiration for a system that can juggle all of these contradictory goals, keep all of its constituencies somewhat happy, and keep growing.
David Labery is a professor of education at Stanford's Graduate School of Education. So, first, do no harm. Second, try to do some good. Education can't solve inequality, but it can help. Over the course of this series, we'll explore the different ways teachers, administrators, and policymakers have reached toward that goal of transforming schools into engines of equality and opportunity. Some of the strategies are more effective than others. To give you just a small taste of what's to come, I'm joined now by Professor of Education Jeremy Stoddard.
I think we do tend to have this belief that there's an easy fix for education.
Jeremy teaches at the College of William and Mary. He studies the way technology is used in schools, which means he knows a thing or two about education trends.
We often are looking for the silver bullet. And those beliefs then, along with the political realities, mean we see sort of things coming back into vogue every 20 or 30 years. So a lot of the things that we're seeing likely aren't brand new.
So he sees four big trends in education today. A return of project or play-based learning, individualized education, new forms of assessment, and something called a pathways approach. So, Jeremy, let's talk about the four big trends that are rising in popularity and start with the project or play-based learning. What's that?
So project-based learning, in its current form, I think has emerged out of a bit of this maker movement. So the idea that everyone wants to learn through sort of building or constructing things. And essentially what it is kids building stuff and they're learning while they're building.
And that's what the seniors are doing in this classroom at High Tech High. It's a public charter in San Diego that encourages project-based learning.
And that gives you a buffer, right? Okay, so because all you really need to do now is you're just gluing it. You're going to glue the two knives together.
They're working on a joint humanities and science project where they build boats, then market them to real clients.
It goes back to even people like John Dewey, who was an educational theorist from the early 1900s. And his idea was that students would learn well through engaging in sort of active learning where they're making mistakes and learning from them, where they're building things, where they're learning about physics, thermodynamics, biology from cooking an egg multiple times and trying to mess around with it. And so it's this sort of messing around with it is the way that people can learn.
Okay, so watch.
Jeremy says these days, project-based learning is just as likely to include video games as it is shop class.
Wait, try doing
These third graders at High Tech Elementary are working together to figure out a math computer game.
What do we have to do?
I don't know.
You know, as with anything, the quality of these can range. The worst example is sort of the classroom diorama that the kids really are just copying from something. So if they're building a Civil War ambulance out of candy, they're not going to learn a whole lot from doing that. But if they're trying to solve sort of a really complex problem that has multiple and competing answers from it, then I think it can be a really worthwhile experience as compared to, you know, sitting and taking notes.
Another idea that is growing in popularity is finding alternatives to standardized testing. Talk about that a little.
The reason we have a lot of the standardized tests that we have in place right now is because they're very efficient. It's very easy to compare students on those types of items because they're either right or they're wrong. But teachers tend to, as we say, teach the test. And what that means is if the test is largely based on their ability to memorize and recall things, then that's what teachers are going to be doing in the classroom.
Schools around the country have experimented with alternatives to standardized testing.
So when I was a teacher in Minnesota back in the 1990s, the state there was piloting a statewide, essentially project-based learning type of standardized assessment system. So all of my students in my seventh grade were doing local history projects. We had rubrics. They're all held to the same standards. If you can imagine, though, all of the seventh graders across an entire state, it gets to be a really logistical challenge when we're talking about assessing written work.
And this is where new technology comes in handy.
So, for example, science assessments that look a lot like video games, but within the games they're actually assessing students' abilities to conduct essentially science inquiry. And the feedback that we can get from the games tell us what they can do well and what they're not doing well in these really more complex matters of thinking. And I think that's a big difference compared to the standardized assessments we see today.
Finding new forms of assessment also leads to Jeremy's third trend in education, individualized instruction, which often relies on this assessment technology.
So one of the big trends for the past 15 years or so has been the notions of individualized education and sort of this mantra of data-based decision-making. So that we're going to have these assessments on kids that are going to help us to inform what they need to succeed.
Bob Pianta, Dean of the Curry School of Education at the University of Virginia, explains a little more about how this works.
What technology is doing a little bit is blurring the distinction between assessment and instruction. The machine is learning about you. I think what happens, people think of machine learning. They think, oh, we're turning all these kids into machines or we're turning teachers into machines. But in point of fact, we're using the machine to do things that oftentimes were done accidentally or by luck, you know, on the part of a teacher. Oh, I figured this out about you today because I just happened to ask you this question, you know, and too bad I wasn't able to ask all 25 of my kids a similarly individualized question today. That technology is a very, very powerful tool. Assessment systems have become like teachers.
This is one of those things that there may be a lot of potential in the future for. What it currently looks like, though, is, for example, a kid reading a book, taking tests, they get a certain score on it. It tells the teacher, can they go on to the next reading level or not? So I think individualized education at this point is being pushed really heavily by tech companies. They see it as a real growth area. The big question I always have is, who's really benefiting from these types of programs?
The last trend we're going to look at is the Pathways model. Jeremy, talk to me a little about the Pathways model.
Pathways is a term that's being used sort of broadly, but usually it's referring to helping students, even while they're in high school, start to go down certain pathways, which aligns with maybe where they're going to go post-secondary.
Oh, it's vocational education.
Some of it is. So some of it used to be referred to as vocational education, although today that could be engineering. A pathway could be leading to healthcare.
This idea that not all kids need four-year college prep plays out in places like Dabney S. Lancaster Community College.
You know, by 2020, 70% of jobs will require some form of post-secondary education and not necessarily a four-year degree.
This is John Renone, the president of Dabney Lancaster Community College. which offers degrees and certificates in things like forensic science, wind turbine technology,
advanced manufacturing, baking and pastry, microcomputer applications, small business management. For every occupation that might require a master's degree, there are typically two professional jobs that might require a four-year degree. There are seven jobs that require basically a one-year certificate or a two-year degree. That's the sort of the 1-2-7 model, and we're training the people in the sevens.
So a pathways model means high schoolers who plan to get one of these certificates spend their time preparing for that kind of work instead of preparing for a four-year degree.
The question is, will these pathways really work for all kids, and who do they work for and who don't they work for? These things tend to be very class-based. Kids from lower working classes were automatically tracked into the types of trades, types of career paths that tended to align with those classes.
Of these four things that you see as really main trends that we're moving toward in education, what do you think is the most helpful and present happening now?
I think the one with probably the most potential to change what we see happen in classrooms is likely the assessment, because that's really what's driving classrooms right now. And in my mind, it's driving us in the wrong direction. If the sort of emphasis on accountability continues, and accountability meaning the emphasis is on how well kids score on assessments, how well teachers, students score on assessments, and that's where the emphasis is placed, then unless we change the assessment, we're not going to change the educational system in general. You know, the other trend that we haven't really talked about is just helping teachers to do all of these things better, and valuing teacher work and paying teachers well and having them in a professional situation. And that, I think, is probably more valuable than any technological solution. That's what we know works.
Jeremy Stoddard is a professor of education at the College of William & Mary. This program was funded by a grant to Dr. Oliver Hill at Virginia State University by the National Science Foundation. The National Endowment for the Humanities is a proud supporter of With Good Reason. The NEH is committed to providing Americans with opportunities to understand, to discover new perspectives, and to reflect and engage. Major support for With Good Reason is provided by the Shia Khan Foundation and by the law firm of McGuire Woods. Support also comes from the University of Virginia Health System, pioneering treatments to save lives and preserve brain function for stroke patients, uvahealth.com. With Good Reason is produced by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Elliot Majerzik, Allison Quance, Lilia Fukin, and John Last are our associate producers. Jeannie Palin handles listener services. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
This is the magic of radio, and you are listening to WHFR Dearborn.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.